Well, welcome to After Hours. I'm sorry I was off last week. I want to thank Chris Jones and Mark Carroll for filling in, but I am back now, and it's a full two-hour show, and there's lots to do. And my first guests, and it's shocking to me, Anne Pringle Burnell is in here with her husband, Mark Burnell, but I knew Anne as Anne Pringle, and I knew Anne as a waitress at a place called Yvette, where in the, oh my God, and it's so scary, in 1986.
Oh my God.
There was an amateur singing contest that I judged with a piano player named Al Blatter, long gone. Maybe you remember, some of you remember Al fondly. He was a character.
He was a character.
And we heard dozens, if not hundreds, of the worst singers that I've ever heard in my life. Until, and I wrote about it, until Al turns to me and says, "Holy cow, pay attention, listen to that. That was you, Anne Pringle. And we awarded you the prize, whatever it might have been." Knowing Bob John Garrett, it was a day off or a glass of champagne or something. You came over to us and said, "Should I quit my job and try to make a go as a singer?" "Yes," we said, without really thinking. I'm reading from an old story. "Do it." "I will," she said. "Watch for me." My name, we didn't even know your name. My name is Anne Pringle. You've made, I think, a remarkable career for yourself. Do you regret?
No.
Anything about it?
Leaving the waitress job? No.
Well, but also the music business. Mark, get in on this too. The music business is one chaotic. Everybody thinks, oh, they're a club performer. Isn't that great? And they will see you at a club or some other venue and think, oh, these guys have got to have the most rarefied, wonderful life. It's a hustle. You do it. You have to do it for love, don't you?
It's a hard way to make a living, and you have to be really creative, and you have to be wear a lot of hats, play a lot of styles.
And be willing to morph a little bit in your career. So as the scene changed, we kind of went into the theaters and did concerts and instead of nightclubs every night.
What do you think? Give me, both of you, because you know it well, your estimation of a state of the club scene in Chicago. The first place I ever saw you, and I remember it fondly, is a place called Boombola, which was on Lincoln Avenue.
Oh, God.
Wow. Yeah.
Cabarets.
Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Give me a state of the scene.
Much less clubs, far fewer places to play. I'm still fortunate to be playing the club scene. I play down the street at the Tortoise Club. I lead a jazz trio on Saturdays, and I've been there for 4 years.
But that place just opened.
Club 4 years old.
Yeah,
it is. Yes. That makes it a new club. It's beautiful, that place. I've only been in the bar.
They have the walls of the Pump Room in there.
I didn't know
the wooden walls.
The wooden walls when you first come in. Yeah. I tell people that. I'm like, these are the walls. They have the energy of the Pump Room.
Wow. How did you get that job? I mean, how do you...
I auditioned.
Wow. And 40 years is a very steady gig. Is it not? I mean, it's not every night, but
no, it's just Saturdays.
Well, you started with four nights.
I did. And I used some really good local bass players and drummers. So it's really a lot of fun.
Do you think, I mean, now, there's an open mic thing at Sayat Nova, just around the corner from here, an old venerable kind of Armenian restaurant that has recently started featuring music. Do you feel, the two of you, Mark and Anne Burnell, a return? Are you hopeful? Forget what's happening in politics, but are you hopeful?
I think that's a reason people need to go seek out music. They have to get away from the television, and they have to get away. So when 9/11 happened, it's not the same thing, I know, but we were in like a club at Lush Life, and people were just coming in droves and hanging out. Like, it was very...
Right. Music is healing, and it makes people feel better when they hear live music.
But there's also, to me, it's like whatever urge made people... millions of years ago, or hundreds of thousands of years ago, or thousands of years ago, gather around
at a campfire.
There is that need for human connection, too. You can plug headphones in and listen to all the music you want of any kind, but there's also something, Talk to me about, you see it when you play, don't
right.
you?
That live connection happens in theater. That doesn't happen in films, you know.
Because it's dark and people aren't supposed to talk. Yeah.
Yeah. And there is an energy interaction in the room.
One of the interesting things, and I'm going to keep you guys till a quarter two, if you don't mind.
Wonderful.
We don't mind.
When I wrote in this piece, your first performance I reviewed, that's one of the upsides and downsides of the internet. Pringle not only sings, but understands her version of Cry Me a River.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding?
Nope. Not only hit the tune's vengeful tone, but tasted as well of its plaintive bitterness. We have not in memory heard this song more compellingly sung. And the other selections also showed a sensitivity to lyrics that is rare, especially for a young performer. Which leads me to the Skokie Theater on February 24th at 7:30, where you are going to do Cry Me a River, a Julie London tribute. Is that not remarkable? And before I play, I'm going to play it right after we take a little break. But when you have lived... And you too, Mark, when you have lived with a song for decades.
I had no idea.
I know. Neither did I. How does your life and your changes in your life influence a song? You cannot possibly sing it the same way today as you sang it then. You, Mark, cannot play it the same way you played
it. It's not possible for jazz musicians.
We never do anything twice.
The same way.
Yeah.
So do you feel
as you're doing it, though, a sense of change and or growth? I would think both.
If it's a great song and you have a passionate relationship with a song and what it means, you just you live the song every time you play it.
I think you never know what's going to sort of hit you in the back of the head emotionally for the song, but there has to be a thread of a connection to it that's truthful. It's not going to read.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back, if we could, with Anne Pringle singing a contemporary version, not the
version
I heard 30 years ago.
Oh, this is Julie London singing it, I believe.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, she's
well, then
the
I
one
want
who...
you to comment on
okay.
that.
Julie
That's
London's
what I want you to do.
Most famous hit.
All right. After we come back from a commercial break, in which I will tell you, learn how real Chicagoans live, the day-to-day struggles and successes with health, fitness, and food. Watch Living Healthy Chicago Sundays at 11:30 a.m. on WGN-TV.
Just to prove you do. cry me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river over you.
She's a good singer, Julie London, but she's not. She's no Anne Burnell. What is it about Julie London? Again, the show is Cry Me a River, Julie London tribute, and Mark Burnell. Mark is a musical director and pianist and arranger and many things, and you've got a guitarist coming, and you've got Paul Wertico on drums. This is a big deal.
Not just any guitarist. What
Who
you
it?
Just heard was the legendary Barney Kessel.
On the recording.
On that recording.
Yeah. But we
and
have,
we have
Henry...
our own Barney Kessel.
We have Henry Johnson on guitar.
He plays for Ramsey Lewis.
What's the seed of this show? I mean, I know, obviously, if one of the first songs I ever heard you sing was Cry Me a River. What's the seed of this show and the affection for Julie London and her music? Because I think Julie London is one of those characters who I'm not... You could find... Hundreds of people say, I love Julie London, and they couldn't name you one other song than that, but her repertoire was huge, right?
Her repertoire was huge. I didn't know when I undertook this research, but I felt like I had to listen to almost all of her songs, and I think I have. And I picked like 88. I whittled it down to, but Mark had to whittle it down even further than that for
sure.
The show. But she recorded a wealth of albums, like 29 albums and two compilation albums in a very short period of time. Before that, she was a movie star.
Right.
And, you know, a pinup girl. She was exquisitely beautiful.
Well, do you think that's one of the reasons she didn't attain the stature of some less comely singers? You know
like
what I mean?
Ella Fitzgerald.
Like, exactly. Or even Sarah Vaughan or even
right.
Billie Holiday.
Oh, looks are important. There's
and
no...
we don't want to get into race even in this thing. But,
no.
I mean, she was a knockout.
And she sounded like she looked.
She yes.
was gorgeous. And
yeah.
you had, it was that soft, breathy, smoky voice. And
Well, she was friends with all of those people. I mean, she was friends with Ella, and she was on the Diana Shore, yeah, show. And
was,
oh, they
she,
all had
was she in her time then, and was she regarded at that same level?
Well, Billboard awarded her the
Female Singer of the Year, like,
three years in a row.
So she was very popular, yeah.
Why do you think her reputation has, in perspective, faded a bit then?
I don't know if it's... There's an underappreciated, you know, people don't know that she's an incredible singer. I guess, you know, the people who know, they know.
Right.
But would they compare her to a Sarah Vaughan or a Billie Holiday?
No, she's...
You know, no, but when you, it's a much more subtle and intimate experience, and she's an actress first.
And that's why the text sounds so believable. She really knew how to tell a story
yeah.
in a song.
Good point.
Because
words,
of her acting background.
Good point.
You know, like she would
yeah,
scoop
right.
things. And,
right.
Yeah. And then I think they sold a lot of records with the album covers to young men.
Yeah,
for
yeah,
sure.
It was like Playboy before there was a Playboy
yeah.
or something like that.
And they knew it. So they knew they had a successful...
What happened with her career? What did she just get older and stop?
Well, she played Nurse Dixie on Emergency.
She was
Did
in the
70s, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Remember,
yes,
she had
I don't remember.
Emergency
That's one of my
exclamation
problems.
Point.
Sadly, I only remember things that happened in nightclubs.
And Jack Webb.
Her ex-husband was the producer, one of the producers.
And got Bobby Troup, her husband,
yeah,
jazz pianist, to play on the show also.
Yeah.
What a fascinating life.
So a lot of people, you know, in the 70s, like, didn't really know she was this great singer.
Wow, and those two things just, I mean, they obviously worked against her in some
I
sort
think
of
we'll
strange,
find out.
Fascinating way.
Yeah. Well, the definitive biography is coming out in July this year, and it's written by a music archivist in San Francisco. His name is Michael Owen, and he, hopefully he's listening. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Michael. Yeah, it's earlier there.
Yeah, it is earlier there. He's wrote a book called Go Slow, which was, I believe, Julie's favorite song. And so it's the Julie London biography called Go Slow. You can order it on Amazon. That's how I met it.
Now, are you during the show, Cry Me a River, Julie London Tribute, at the Skokie Theater on February 24th at 7:30, are you going to bridge biographical stuff between songs?
A little bit. Yeah. We're going to use the material to hopefully tell a little bit about her life. So three songs or something about how she liked to, you know, hang out with the musicians, and she and Bobby Troup had, you know, sessions at their house where everybody jammed until the wee hours of the morning. And yeah, so we're going to have a bunch of night songs. And then,
just like you guys, right?
Yeah.
Just like you two.
We stay up late.
Did you, before deciding on Julie London, had you toyed with any other? Because I do like the theme nature of shows, and I think that's a tremendously effective way to sell a show to an audience who hasn't run into you in clubs. Right. I mean, I do think the two of you on your own would be well worth whatever the ticket price is at any place I can think of. But, you know, where's your audience? You know, you've got to, you know, you're going to draw people from the Tortoise Club and here and there. I think the notion of a theme show with an identifiable singer is a great idea. Did you toy with any other singers beforehand?
Well, we owe it to Bobby Ojeda, the trumpet player who
worked
with us on the Arlen album, Blues in the Night. And he toured with Julie.
So he would tell me stories about her when we were at Andy's Jazz Club. You know, he's like, yeah, just talking about hanging out with Julie and the guys in the band after the show and having drinks and food and making more music. And she was just one of the guys. Yeah.
Well,
with her
really
curlers
hard.
And everything.
Ladies and gentlemen, sometime during a commercial here, I shouldn't tell you this, but go Google Julie London if you don't know what she looked like. Just Google Julie London. I'm not even going to abuse you spelling it for you and see what she looked like. And I think in many ways, you can one of the guys after the show, that would be a dream come
very
true.
Very surprising,
for
right?
Oh, yeah. Is it a one-act show? Is it a straight through
with no
eight song? Eight? Nine, ten songs?
Oh, no, there's 20.
20?
About 25?
I can't remember. Yet.
Wow.
Now, they go quick, and I think the show's around 80
little,
minutes.
They're little two-minute, two-and-a-half-minute, you know,
yeah,
pieces.
Which that one was. Which, yeah. You know, it's a whole tune.
And as long as it takes to smoke a cigarette.
That's true.
Yeah.
I wonder what that means to anybody. But we will keep these two. Do we have to break, Tom, at 27 or go all the way to 29, 27? All right, we're going to take a break. Then we're going to come back and talk about not only promote this show a little more, Cry Me a River, Julie London Tribute, at the Skokie Theater, February 24th, 7:30. You can go to what's your good website? BurnellMusic.com. Is that the best one? BurnellMusic.com. And you can buy tickets or go to Skokie Theater and you can buy tickets too. We'll take a little break and then we'll get some news. Then you will hear, want to play Girl Talk?
Oh, yeah. Her husband wrote that, Bobby Troup.
All right. We can listen to that, or I got a right to sing the blues.
Talked about Ojeda. Maybe we'll do that one.
Yeah, we'll do that one.
We don't have to play the whole thing. It's a long song.
No, we won't. But I also want to talk about your other career as a
Pilates person.
I like to call you, I don't even know what Pilates is, but as a fitness instructor. This is how real musicians make their money. They have other jobs. We'll be right back.
We never have to be.
We'll be right back.
Knows I song. Wouldn't take long to give my heart away. I know it's plain. My heart's in pain. My song couldn't belong to someone feeling gay. I got a right to sing the blues. I got a right to feel low down. I got a right to hang around.
Well, that sounds good. What's that?
That is from my album Blues in the Night, and it was arranged by Bob Ojeda, the trumpet player.
The aforementioned Bob Ojeda.
The aforementioned Bob Ojeda from, he was with Count Basie's band for many years, wrote arrangements for them.
One of the things you two, being relatively still young on this scene, is the Chicago jazz cabaret club scene is, if not, I've always thought it was the most nurturing on earth. Am I wrong? Am I naive?
You mean for young people to start and
for anybody going in this business? I mean, depending on your age, you are nurtured for a while,
yeah,
and then you nurture. I mean, I find it an amazing thing.
It is
thing.
A supportive.
Yeah.
It's a supportive group. I'm on the board of the Chicago Cabaret, and we try to create shows for people when they're just starting up to do strut their stuff. And just do like half a show at Davenport's. And it's a really, you know, supportive place. And then we have group shows where everybody just does one number. And yeah, it's nice.
What do you tell kids who are coming in and saying and looking at your careers and saying, I want to do what you do? Do you ever sit them down and say, man, this is, it ain't as easy as it looks?
Well, I tell them to study with me. I coach singers. But you're right. It's a tough way to make a living.
Yeah.
Mark is a fantastic.
Well, I mean,
coach,
it's very much like, you know, some kid saying, "Oh, I want to be a newspaper columnist one day," and I said, "Well, see, newspapers are fading.
Yeah,
there aren't as many, and it's going away. You want to be sort of hopeful without being delusional,
right?"
Well, I don't delude my students. If they have talent, I will help them along. That's for sure.
He
and there's still a place to help them along too. Is there not?
Well, I can help them make a demo. They can sing with me at open mics that I host. So there's opportunities for them to develop.
They need to get their feet wet and well, the open mics are a great place for that.
Yeah, part of the thing is just getting out there and doing it, if indeed you have talent. And you have another career, do you not?
Yes.
Because sometimes people say, hey, I met a friend of yours. I go, really? They say, yeah, Anne Burnell. And I go, oh, where do you see her? Well, in my class. And I said, my gosh, she's teaching. This is for years now. You're also a fitness instructor. How long have you been doing that?
Probably 20-plus years I've been doing it. I've taught everything from, you know, kickboxing, Thai boat, everything. And I've kind of landed on the Pilates, water, you know.
Where do you do this?
I'm at 6 different places, so I'm... I was at the Rehab Institute for 5 years, and I finished that contract, and now I'm at Swedish Covenant Hospital.
Oh, wow.
And Northwestern Hospital.
Well, they must get reward. There must be something rewarding in that, too, is there not?
It's very rewarding. It's very rewarding.
And it may not be as easy as making someone feel good if they're having two drinks
in a
bar, but yeah. Now, if this Julie Wilson show, which takes place Friday at the Skokie Theater at 7:30, might you make a return with this show other places, or might you move on to another, I don't want to put pressure on you, but might you move on to, if it goes well, to a, you know, a sort of a tribute to another singer?
Oh, sure. We could put, you know, another show together. This has been probably like 6 months of work.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're not thinking down the line just yet.
Yeah, no, no. Yeah,
I mean, we think it has wheels. We'd like to do it again.
We wonder if it could be performed other places besides Chicago, other venues, even a jazz venue, because she loved to sing in intimate nightclubs and with very sparse arrangements. And so I think it would be nice.
What about, before I let you go back to your home, which is, thank God, isn't too far from here, what about the recording business itself has changed as radically in the last 30 years as has the movie business, the newspaper business, and everything else?
Mm-hmm.
It used to be a huge, huge deal
to release
a CD. Not just to release one, but to make one, because there was a narrative to the selections. You know what I mean? You just didn't toss a bunch of songs in there and randomly and hope, ooh, someone may download this. There was no downloading. How has that changed your lives?
The computer has really revolutionized everything.
Everything.
In that, I've made a couple of albums at our house. It's that easy with a computer.
The big thing, I think, is that the major labels no longer hold a big, that they don't hold the nut, the candy jar the whole time.
Right, right.
So now performers can, go directly to their audience on YouTube, right there. There's not...
For instance, Julie was with the same label her entire
career. That just wouldn't happen.
No.
You appreciate the freedom as you give up the freedom, giving up the sort of stable that you might have been in.
Right.
Both of you.
Well, and you too. I mean, the Chicago Tribune.
I don't mind being here now. But I'm just saying that it would be very difficult for a newspaper writer to start, selling individual stories in different places.
It'd be hard. A lot of those writers.
But what a lot of those big labels did was give the kind of support. They'd put you on tour. They'd advertise you.
Right.
But you appreciate the new freedom you have.
Well, we just did a CD. Henry Johnson produced the last one, and it took 2 years to do. So we're not as fast as Julie London turning out two CDs a year. But he worked with my vocal style and how to work with the different colors in my voice, so finding the different places. And I feel like I've explored a whole new voice now. And
You can also pick and choose your collaborators. They are not dictated by some outside force. You two, it has been a great joy to watch your career low these 30 years. I'm glad you found each other, whatever that was. I met you before I met Mark. Well, that doesn't mean anything. You did sing Cry Me a River the first time I reviewed your show.
I can't believe that.
That's pretty stunning. Once again, Mark and Ann Burnell, along with Henry Johnson and Paul Wertico, will be playing at the Skokie Theater February 24th, that's this Friday, at 7:30. It is Cry Me a River, a Julie London tribute. If you haven't Googled images of Julie London, you have missed the boat. You can still do it. That's one of the great things about computers. You can go to Burnell Music, Burnell Music.com to get tickets, or to Skokie Theater to get tickets. You guys, congratulations.
Thanks, Rick.
You fight the good fight out there, and it's your passion and it's your love, and that means a lot in these dark times. So take care, get home safe. We'll be right back. Every first Tuesday of the month for last month and this coming month, I have been performing with the maestro of all maestros, Michael Miles, the great, great, great musician who's been a guest on this show. We started this thing last month. It's called Panorama, and it is sort of a gathering of stories and songs and Michael's amazing music, and we kind of do it around a theme. Last one was sort of the presidential election, which had just happened. This one is going to be probably heavily politics as well, but there are always surprise guests. Michael knows everybody in the music business. The show is at The Hideout, which is on West Wabansia, hideoutchicago.com. It is this Tuesday night at 6:30. It's only an hour and a half. Last week, I told some stories about Patty Bowler, Studs Terkel, Mike Royko, Martin Luther King, and Michael played some amazing music. I'm going to give you right now a sort of sample of what it's Michael's creative genius. Believe me, it is his creative genius that makes this show work, but it's only, I think it's only $10 to get in. So if you're in the neighborhood, hideoutchicago.com, Tuesday night at 6:30. Here's a clip from last month's show.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine.
Alexander Hamilton, 1788, Federalist Paper number 72. Listen closely, he might well have been talking about the Affordable Care Act. Men often oppose a thing merely because they have had no agency in planning it, or because it may have been planned by those whom they dislike. But if they have been consulted and have happened to disapprove, opposition then becomes, in their estimation, an indispensable duty of self-love. They seem to think themselves bound in honor, and by all the motives of personal infallibility, to defeat the success is what has been resolved upon, contrary to their sentiments. Men of upright, benevolent tempers have too many opportunities of remarking with horror to what desperate lengths this disposition is sometimes carried, and how often the great interests of society are sacrificed to the vanity, to the conceit, and to the obstinacy of individuals who have credit enough to make their passions and their caprices interesting to mankind. Perhaps the question now before the public may, in its consequences, afford melancholy proofs of the effects of this despicable frailty, or rather, detestable vice in the human character. Alexander Hamilton.
imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. Nothing to kill or die for. A brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing.
That's Michael Miles Verkogenen's lovely, I can't remember her name, Nora, a friend of Michael's who was playing the bass. I'll give you a little more of what we do at the Hideout. We don't know what we're doing this Tuesday, but it's going to be some combination of humor, politics, music, a lot of music, because that's what Michael does. Also stories and some Chicago history. Here's a bit of what I did at the Hideout last month on 1968 and Martin Luther King. It is 1968, and the aforementioned Mayor Richard J. Daley's life is shadowed by worry. He is not, with the Democratic Convention scheduled to come to town, worried about war protesters and other long-haired agitators. Daley knew and was not afraid of their principal weapons because they were just words. The people he feared most might upset the convention were blacks. His paranoia, fueled by the riots early in the year that devastated portions of the West Side in the wake of the April assassination of the aforementioned Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So it was decided before the convention that police would pressure various black militants and gang members, arrest some, hassle some, get across the behave or else message. But Daley, politically savvy in the extreme, had a much less aggressive maneuver. And on August 1st, 1968, the city council met to placate the entire black community of Chicago by renaming a street. Many descriptions of that city council meeting have been written, none better than who else, Mike Royko. Quote, "The meeting was remarkable, with one administration alderman after another eulogizing King as a great man, forgetting that they assailed him when he was alive. Daley himself described his relationship with King as one of great friendship and mutual understanding, claiming that King had told him what a fine job he was doing for the city's blacks." Laugh is right. The heights to which Daley and his aldermen rose in praising King moved one observer to write, "It was enough to bring tears to your eyes if you happened to be a crocodile." The street selected for the name change was South Parkway, which ran through the predominantly black sections of the South Side. There were, from some aldermen, suggestions that the street chosen would be one that cut through the whole city, Western Avenue, maybe. But Daley wouldn't listen. He knew that in white neighborhoods, the street signs would be defaced or destroyed,
And that is why and how South Parkway became Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Drive. And a few weeks later, the Democrats came to town.
And man, that's another portion of what was on stage at the Hideout last month during Panorama. Come see Panorama this Tuesday, 6:30. Me, Michael Miles, and God knows who else, but Michael has a lot of talented friends. Go to hideoutchicago.com and see you there. We got a short commercial break, then I'll get the news to you, and then you'll hear from Ron Rappaport live from California. Well, just a short Bill Curtis. Hey, I'm Bill Curtis. Bill's a friend of mine, but it's like he pops in here like you think, oh, my God, he's here somewhere. He's
over
here.
Your shoulder.
Yes, he is over my shoulder. Hey, you're my guest in a couple of weeks, pal.
Oh, and yes. You know that we have a connection with the Hideout.
What?
Tim Tutton.
Oh, my God. How do you know Timmy?
Tim and I worked together when I was teaching at Chicago Public Schools, and he was kind of over my department in a way. And I've maintained a friendship and connection with him all the way through his time in Washington, D.C.
That's wild. Roger, you were like Zelig, man. You were like everywhere. I can't wait for part two of the Roger Badish story, which I think is not next Sunday, but the Sunday afterward. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. The news is brought to you by Penny Mustard Furnishing and is delivered by the one and only Roger Badish. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Gogan. I'm sure Donald Trump will take absolute credit for what sounds like the highest scoring basketball game in All-Star game history. Ron Rappaport was one of the most distinguished newspaper men in the long and storied history of this newspaper town as a sports columnist for the Sun-Times and then in another town in L.A. as a sports columnist out there. He has made a decent career since of writing books and editing books. His latest is The Lost Journalism of Ring Lardner. He's an old friend of mine, Ron. It's good to talk to you, as
good
always.
Good to talk to you, Rick. It's a pleasure.
The
auto traffic report made me home.
This book is a remarkable thing, and The Lost Journalism of Ring Lardner. You've got, when you were a young sports columnist in this town, did you feel, Ron, the shadow of Ring Lardner at all?
Well, I think he was, he was not a generation or two generations ago, Rick. He was a century ago.
Yeah, he died. Yeah, exactly. He died in 1933.
Right. He wrote for the Tribune in 1911 to 1919, and we were talking about more than a century ago when he started. And so I don't think he was a shadow as much as a presence. We certainly knew who he was more by his name and, of course, his famous short stories.
Sure.
That are part of the literary canon. Everybody reads Haircut in high school,
And you know Meow.
Of course. They've always been in print. But his career as a journalist is another story. I always assumed that, yes, he covered baseball for the Tribune, and in fact for the Interocean and the Examiner before that.
Sure.
And then he wrote the In the Wake of the News column for a bunch of years. But then I figured, the stories became popular, and he became a short story writer.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out not to be true. Ring was a journalist his entire working life. He turned out far more journalism, I would say 10, 15, 20 times more than he did the stories. And there were months and weeks and months and even years went by when he would not write a new short story. But he was always writing journalism, both for the Tribune, and then when he moved to Great Neck of Long Island, where he was hanging around with people like F. Scott Fitzgerald. Wouldn't you have liked to have been at the bartender for some of their events?
But yes, exactly. That would have been exhausted.
Writing a weekly column every week for 8 years from 1919 to 1927. Then he was even doing more journalism after he stopped doing that. He wrote every single week while he was writing the stories and you know, writing the stories that made him famous, and the journalism kind of got lost in the shuffle, and that was what I was wanted to kind of correct that the record on.
Well, you've done more than correct it, Ron, with the lost journalism of Ring Lardner. You've also impressed me. What impressed me is that there is no way that I thought of, though he was primarily a sports writer, certainly, and famous as such, he also delved into everything. He covered politics. He covered the waterfront, as they say.
Well, he wrote about Prohibition. He went to World War One. He went over for a while to write a book, and he ended up sending back daily dispatches to the Tribune. He never went to where the war was, but he found something funny in World War One. You know, he wrote about the craft of journalism to a great extent, on and on and on. He wrote about his family a lot. He wrote about the neighborhood where he lived in the house that he lived in Long Island. He wrote about his travels. He was a frequent traveler. He wrote about everything under the sun, anything that occurred to him. And going back and looking at it, it's kind of an interesting look at the 1920s as seen through Ring's kind of jaundiced eye, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think his jaundiced eye, I mean, talking about a jaundiced eye, one of his greatest admirers was H.L. Mencken, for God's sake.
Well, you kind of had to stand in line to appreciate Ring, both with the stories and the journalism. Mencken loved him. Edmund Wilson, the great critic, loved him. A young high school student in Oak Park, Illinois, named Ernest Hemingway, signed his columns. Ring Lardner Jr.
Yeah, that may be the greatest sort of example of fame, is that the young Hemingway who didn't admit to admiring many people in his long and crazy life. One of the first he admired was Ring Lardner.
And then one of my favorites is that over in England, Virginia Woolf, who didn't know second base for Westminster Abbey, loved Ring. She thought he was great. Thought the You Know Me Al stories were terrific, you know.
Well, one of the things is, Ron, and I'm going to keep you the whole half hour because I just think people need to. And it's a great Hirschfeld drawing on the cover of your book, too, The Lost Journalism of Ring Lardner, is that he, as prolific as he was, he had, so to speak, and I will ever say this about Royko, too, who wrote five or six columns a week, his batting average in the crazy field of journalism was astronomical, don't you think? He didn't have many swinging outs when he wrote a piece, did he?
No. I always thought that Royko, your hero and mine,
yeah,
that the greatest thing about him was his batting average.
No question.
He was just so great so often. Now Ring, the thing about, even when he, might have missed, didn't have his fastball that day.
Yeah.
You could see the craft. You could see the time that he took. You could almost see the sweat forming on his brow. Mm. He didn't do throwaway stuff. He didn't do stuff off the top of his head.
Yeah.
You can really see in reading the stories. And many of the columns he wrote, he used the jargon. He used the vernacular that he was so famous for.
Well, that's the other thing. We got to take a short little break. I'm on with Ron Rappaport, the former distinguished Chicago sports writer and LA Times sports writer, and the author now of an increasing number of books, the latest of which is The Lost Journalism of Ring Lardner, which you need to have, because if the name rings a bell, that bell will be blaring in your head when you pick up this book and read the story. So we'll be right back after I tell you, explore Chicago's culinary side with Chicago Tribune's Food and Dining Newsletter. Sign up today at chicagotribune.com/newsletters and live deliciously. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. We're talking to Ron Rappaport, who was, in 2016, the winner of the Ring Lardner Award for Excellence in Sports Journalism. Ron, you told a great story at the time to me. You said when Rick Tellender of the Sun-Times called to tell you that, you laughed out loud.
It was a joke. I mean, I thought either he was in my brain, Rick has lots of talents, but I thought, boy, that was really quite remarkable, because I had just pushed the button on sending the book to the publisher at that day.
I know, that's so funny. The funny thing was you would come across a Lardner piece and put it in one of your previous books, a brilliant book from Black Sox to three-peats, a century of Chicago's best sports writing from the Tribune, Sun-Times, and other newspapers. I adore that book.
Oh, thanks.
But that was kind of what led you to start digging more. I mean, this guy, as much as you may have heard about him, really started to intrigue you, and you found a treasure trove.
Well, I went back to the archives. Luckily, the Tribune is online and searchable.
Yeah.
So I could do it in my pajamas, really. But I had to go to Boston, the Boston Public Library, where he worked there for a number of years. I had to scout around in papers like Ring wrote when he was writing from Long Island. He appeared in 150 newspapers, 8 million readers. He was the most popular journalist in the country. And because of the Busher stories, was one of the most popular people in the country, one of the best known, along with presidents and Charles Lindbergh and the rest of them. Anyway, I had to find the columns appeared in a bunch of papers, like the Joliet Spring Herald or the Omaha paper and the paper in Boise, Idaho, to find all of the, or as many as I could, of the literally hundreds of columns that he wrote for the Bell Syndicate. And that was a real treasure hunt. It really became fun going from one paper to the next.
Well, and also, there must have been something a little wistful about it when you said to yourself, oh, my God, there were this many papers in the country.
Because, I mean, he appeared in pages of editorial pages and op-ed pages with many, many other writers at the time. These papers were gigantic. Yeah, but to see all the papers that he wrote for.
Yeah.
You know, to see have one guy and 150 newspapers, that doesn't happen now.
No, I'm not sure there are 150 newspapers now. What's it been? You also got to know his family.
Right. His grandson, James, who's a Ring Lardner Jr.'s son, wrote the foreword for me. And his granddaughter, Susan, who is the daughter of the great sports writer John Lardner, is the literary executor. And I don't think I'm giving away any secrets. I don't think Susan would be upset with me if I told her that she gave me the rights at a price I could afford.
Yeah.
So I became friendly with Susan. I was able to meet with her, but not with Jim. And I have to tell you, if I can get a plug in here.
Sure.
That on May the 4th at the Newberry Library, Ring is being inducted into the Chicago Literary Hall of Fame. I'm going to keynote, and Don DeGrazia, the author of American Skin, Columbia College, is going to talk about his short stories. And James Finn Garner, who's the author of Politically Correct series, is going to talk about Lardner's use of humor. And Jim and Susan are going to be there. So I think that anybody who edits a book and asks somebody to write a foreword ought to at some point meet the person.
Maybe not in this electronic age. Oh, I think that's great. May 4th at the Newberry. That is fantastic. Don DeGrazia.
Yeah, we're excited about it. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, I have to write about it beforehand. I have to have you on the show, too. Don's a very interesting guy. Do you know him, Ron?
I do not.
You'll love him.
I'm excited and a little embarrassed about being on the same stage with them, but it's going to be a lot of fun. Also, James Lardner, Ring's grandson, says he's never been to Wrigley Field, so we're going to try to get him to a Cubs game.
I think the Ricketts family would more than give you you would hope.
It ought to be fun.
Yeah.
Jim's a writer in his own right. So is Susan. She wrote for The New Yorker for me.
It's
a very distinguished family. So I'm excited about the event and about the fact that Jim and Susan will be there.
Well, I'm excited about the fact that you are bringing Ring Lardner back to life. I think that, there's some Royko collections out there. You got a Breslin collection or two. But I think the days of collected columns of newspaper writers are over. And I think it's really, really a good thing. Are you proud of yourself?
Well, I'm pleased about it. I agree with you that the days of these collections are over. I feel like I just got in under the wire. But it was fun. It was learning about Ring's life. I got to tell you, Rick, here's something that after all these years having trouble getting my mind around. Ring wrote in the wake of the news from 1913 to 19 for the Tribune every single day.
Yeah.
They wanted him in the paper every day. They said, Ring, some days you could just write something short. He said, well, if you want me in the paper every day, why don't you put in something like Ring Lardner, who does not appear today? But he wrote just about every day for 6 years. And at the same time, he wrote the Busher story. stories that became You Know Me, Al.
Uh-huh.
He wrote Alibi Ike. He wrote Champion. He wrote Gulliver's Travels. He wrote some of his greatest short stories at the same time he was appearing in the Tribune every single day.
Yeah, it is.
You're a writer. You know,
I know. It makes me feel like
a boggles the mind, right?
It makes me feel like a terrible slacker. Plus, he had more than a relatively active social life. I mean, he was
a busy man.
Yes,
he had four sons. He was at the Algonquin Roundtable. He traveled a lot. He wrote for the theater. He wrote musicals. He wrote song lyrics. He had a busy life on Long Island. Where he lived in Long Island was the social center for a lot of wealthy businessmen and show business people.
Yeah.
And the social life was the kind that was portrayed in The Great Gatsby.
Sure.
Moving from lawn to lawn in the course of an evening, you know. So Fitzgerald and Lardner were part of this. Scott Fitzgerald and Lardner were part of this. And Fitzgerald finally abandoned it and went to the south of France where he could get some work done.
Where he could get some rest, yeah. I know, that is the thing about it. And I was not only stunned by the breadth of Lardner's interest, but the ever-high quality of... he was a very clever writer, but he was also, Ron Rappaport, a very clever thinker, too, wasn't he?
Well, I think writing is thinking, but yeah.
Good point.
The thing is that he went in so many directions. He could write about William Jennings Bryan one day and Ty Cobb the next.
Right.
You know? That
right.
kind of a thing. And speak with authority about all of them. He just, you know, he was famous for being a cynic, and it certainly comes across. But I think he just had this incredible curiosity and this amazing work ethic. Yeah. We haven't pointed out the fact that he called himself a two-bottle man.
Right.
Which is to say, two bottles a day.
Yeah.
When you talk about all the other things going on in his life.
It boggles the mind and makes me in many ways really jealous.
So at the very end of his life, Rick, he's sick now. Okay. He's got pneumonia. He starts writing radio columns for The New Yorker. He might have been the first media critic, full-time media critic, in the country. He wrote about what he heard on the radio, and some of it, you know, he's just writing about what he's listening to, and he's in a hospital bed or traveling around the country.
He is a stunning
figure. The stuff he wrote for The New Yorker about the radio is just a scream.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's hilariously.
This book
stands up very well today.
Congratulations. The Lost Journalism of Ring Lardner by Ron Rappaport. Buy it at some internet site through you, and it will change. You know who should read this book is Donald Trump, for God's sake. He thinks the media is no good. He bashes the media. Read this book and do it. Ron, I can't wait to see you in May. I'll have you on a couple weeks before that event.
That'll be great, Rick.
Good luck with the book. It is a great book. You can be very...
Thanks for having me on. And we'll see
you. Stop it anytime. Be very, very proud, will you please?
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. That was Ron Rappaport, the author of... Lost Journalism of Ring Lardner. I mean, this Hemingway, who was a jerk as far as I'm concerned, when he was in high school, he is signing his columns Ring Lardner Jr. or whatever it was. Yeah, Ring Lardner Jr. I mean, so that's how famous he was. That's how famous Ring Lardner was. We'll get some commercials, then we'll get some news, and then we'll talk theater. Welcome back. The laughter, it's okay. It's okay.
We're having too much fun on Sunday. We don't know what to do.
Cocktail party in here. Chicago Slamworks, which has been one of my the Chicago jewels in my life for some time, decided one, two, three years ago to get in the theater business.
I don't know why.
And I don't either. J.W. Bacillo, that's the guy who doesn't know why. I think that was my first 3 years ago. I said, "What the hell are you doing this? It's working out, isn't it?
It's gone pretty well. This is we're coming into the middle of our third season. We just decided we wanted to take performance poetry out of the bars and the libraries and the coffee shops and put it into legit theater where we think performance poetry belongs. And we, of course, have the anchor show, the Uptown Poetry Slam at the Green Mill.
Sure.
Yeah.
The
great Mark Smith, who I just walked off stage and went directly to the car, and now I'm here. And we just really wanted to put it in other places, specifically
theaters.
I do
think now that you've become successful, now I can say to you, it was a great idea.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
No, it really was. I mean, sort of to wrap it in or give it a theatrical foundation.
Sure. Yeah.
I think was a really, really good idea.
Thank you.
Who are your three young friends?
So with me, if you're picturing at home, to my left. Yeah.
Isn't this on?
Are we streaming?
Oh, yeah, we're streaming somewhere.
All right, yeah. So Shelley Elaine Geisler, who was the lead writer and a company member with Chicago Slammer, has been with us from the beginning. She's to my left, followed by Felix Mays, who's doing his second show with the company, as well as Bianca Phipps down at the end, who is also doing her second show with the company.
Okay, you two relative newcomers. Mm-hmm. When you were first approached to do this, what did you think of it? I mean, you obviously are performers and or poets. How did it strike you as, ooh, this is really the next logical step we should be taking?
Logical, no.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure about the marriage between poetry and theater, mm-hmm. Which is odd because I'm a classically trained Shakespearean actor, but that's sort of the extent of poetry and theater for me. I had seen poetry on stage, but I wasn't sure how they would come together. And it is surprisingly smooth and still just as captivating.
Mm. Yeah, it was interesting, actually, because I approached JW first from a very small apartment in Nebraska where I was doing Shakespeare. My boyfriend texted me and was like, hey, there's an audition call for this theater company that combines slam poetry and performance poetry with theater, which is right up my alley because I love doing both. And so I immediately emailed and was like, please, I will do anything. I will send you a video. Here are all the links to the things that I've done before. Like, I'm begging you. And it's been such a great experience because the first show I got to do was about something that I really cared about, which is public education. And being able to tell the story through two separate mediums that have come together in such a beautiful way is great. I love working with this company because it really provides a new way to tell stories, which is amazing.
Shelley and JW, having gone through this, and it is like any art form, an organic kind of art form. Shelley, I want you to tell me, what are the two biggest surprises of starting to go through this? And you could say, you can easily say, oh, Rick, that it's working so fantastic.
That would honestly be one of them. I think.
Were you a little trepidatious at first?
I wasn't trepidatious personally in the sense because I've always enjoyed doing weird stuff in front of audiences, you know, but I think the thing that surprised me was how much audiences connected with our shows, like right off the bat. You know, from the very first show we did, we had people who were so excited about what we were doing and seemed to just kind of connect and mean a lot to them in ways that I certainly didn't anticipate.
To me, the biggest surprise, we knew that we had quality writing. We knew that we had quality performances and performers with us, and we were able to translate that at, say, the Green Mill or some library show or whatever.
Right,
we had no idea what exactly we were getting into when we started doing full-length theater shows. And I feel like the biggest surprise for me was how big of a scope a theater show is. And everybody at this table, we've all done theater. We've all done plays.
Sure.
We all know how that works. But when you start from the ground and go, we have three poems that we think are an interesting sapling or a seed to a bigger show, I was surprised at how much we need to do in order to really, really build the foundation and build that scaffold of creating a whole theater show. And so the first one we did was entirely kind of, I don't know, we got these ideas and we'll throw them together and hopefully it works. And we created what we call the form, which is basically not dissimilar from a review form, a sketch comedy kind of form, because I have, you know, a background at Second City and IO and wherever else. And we did that with poetry, and very quickly it caught on and people were really into what we were doing. So it became, what do we talk about and what do we have to say? So some of the shows have been very specific. We're telling these stories. Some of the shows have been much more, here's a public education thing we're going to take on. And then this show with Nevermind It's Nothing was all like, let's do a fun, ridiculous, sex positive, love positive, really fun show while it's still legal in this country.
Well, love may be a bigger topic than education.
Well, and this is a different kind of love show altogether.
Yeah.
Like this is definitely the anti-Valentine's Day kind of love.
If you don't mind, before we get, I want to talk specifically about the show, which runs from September 17th. That's like yesterday or today.
Oh, no, yeah.
February 17th.
February 17th, yeah.
To March 24th at Stage 773. Mm-hmm. How does it begin You say, oh, we have to do a new show in March.
Yeah, we...
Do you sit around... I don't mean to try to crack the creative code here or steal your creative secrets, but you sit around, you have drinks and say love, education, around Valentine's Day. I mean, it sounds fun.
Yeah, it really is
fun as hell, whatever you guys do. But how does it work?
Well, it started, we kind of sat down and we knew we had a season with 773. We were under contract to do three shows with them this year. And we knew the first show we wanted to do was all about education and all about Chicago Public Schools specifically. So we knew that's what we were going to tackle right off the bat. It was right around the time of the upcoming teacher strike again and all that kind of stuff. And then we knew that we were having was going to land around Valentine's
Day.
When you say
you know.
Yeah.
You knew. How did you know?
We just knew you that it was around Valentine's Day.
And this is the topic that keeps coming up.
I remember the other three people in the room saying, yeah, it's around Valentine's Day. Oh, it opens right after. It'd be cool if we did something tackling like love and relationships, but not like lovey-dovey, normal relationships. And then everybody looked at me and said, do you want to be the one in charge of writing
that's
that one?
True.
How about a sex farce? And, that's how I got tasked with it.
Yeah.
And then you plot it. There's a certain foundation that you're using.
The lead writer kind of builds the foundation of this is what we're going for. And the lead writer kind of takes all of the writing that comes through the writing room and through the meetings that we do and starts to put a narrative around that that beast. And then we all just contribute whatever we feel is relevant. So, I was throwing poems. I was mad at my partner that day. So I wrote a mad at my partner sort of poem and threw that in, and that turned into a part of the show. And then it's a matter of creating as much of a narrative as we can around the things that we have. And that's kind of the lead writer's job. And Shelley had the short end of the stick because she had a wild, disparate swath of things.
Sure.
Love, sex, and everything else in between.
Well, when you talk narrative, you also have to incorporate theme, I suppose, right?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I kind of approached the staff of writers with from the beginning was I was like, I want this to be kind of tackling the transactional side of relationships, in that relationships always have a give or take. You're always making trade-offs, whether it's like I'll wash the dishes if you clean the bathroom to all kinds of other negotiations that we don't need to get into on the radio.
but you all know what we're talking about.
Yeah, sure. And I was really just interested in looking at relationships from that perspective, and I kind of just asked the staff of writers that we had. We have like an incredible staff of writers that were coming from all kinds of different viewpoints on the subject of relationships, and was just kind of like, what can you write about this? And then we got so much like variety, Yeah.
And then it's her job to start to chip away at that and create a show
out
of it.
Or to start to form that narrative.
And make a narrative.
Now, do you two also write, do you not?
Yes.
Yeah. And how, talk to me about your contribution.
So specifically with Nevermind, It's Nothing, I wasn't big in the writing room for this one. Mm-hmm. Me and relationships have a difficult relationship.
Hey, man, wait till you get older. You think you got it hard now, man.
But there, while we're working on the show, once we're in the rehearsal room as actors, the script is in a constant form of or state of change.
Sure.
So we're always tweaking pieces that other writers have contributed and adding little bits. So there, I do have words in it that are mine. I have lines about, we have a coming out series in it, and I wrote for that. But something that happens in a show like this, where poetry is at its core, I feel, is that when a poet is writing a piece, it's specifically their emotions about how they feel about that one thing, where a playwright can kind of step off and write from imagination and write things that they don't necessarily have to experience. All these pieces here are...
And one of the other things is a playwright will cling to their words in a way that sometimes doesn't lead to what sounds like this unbelievably interesting constant collaboration.
Yeah, and we try to create a thing of there, nothing is precious. Everything can be changed. Everything will change. We riff constantly. Whoever has the best line, the best joke, the best feeling, the best idea is what ends up in the show and ends up in the script. And we really try to hold to that as much as possible. So we've worked with some quote-unquote traditional playwrights, and they've had like you said, a little bit of a harder time in terms of adapting to the form that we do. But we change stuff up all the time. And, you know, Bianca's a really accomplished performance poet, slam poet in her own right, and has done had a lot of success before she came to us. And, you know, I can only imagine how much we've twisted all of your words into things over the last couple of shows.
But twist them into beautiful things that were necessary, I think. And that's the interesting part about being able to write for shows like this, in that when you bring a personal experience to the table, it is personal to you, but everyone else in the room has sort of the same feeling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Someone has experienced that feeling, maybe not in those specific words, but certainly that emotion. And so it's nice to be able to hand over a piece of your writing to people that you trust and know that they're going to take it and make it more universal in its specificity.
That's great. We got to take a little break, but I'm here with the fine folks from the Chicago Slam Works. You can go to chicagoslamworks.com to find all the information you need. Never mind, it's nothing, which is also, ladies and gentlemen, a great title. runs through March 24th at Stage 773, which is on Belmont. So we'll be right back. Welcome back. I have a few more minutes with these fine folks from the show. Never mind, it's nothing, which is running through March 24th at Stage 773. Does the show, ladies and gentlemen, change once you have it? It's still got to change. Just knowing JW and meeting the three of you, I'm thinking, well, it must change a little every show.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Sure.
Yeah. Well, that's theater. That's theater always, right? And forever. You'll never see a show, the same show twice. Anywhere you go. But we do have fun with our production.
We really push for a certain amount of precision on stage, but also like this culture of play. We really try to just really encapsulate and have fun with each other and with the actors. And I go a little nuts as the director sitting up in the booth watching it, going like, that wasn't the exact beat that I created for you. But
but they laughed and it was okay.
But it works. More often than not, they kill it. And I look like a genius because of it.
Who is, now that you've been doing it for three seasons, who's coming to these shows, Shelley? Who's coming to these shows?
Oh, lots of people have friends. their friends come.
Just us and our friends.
That's why we have a cast of 17.
Friends come. 98 of us. It's interesting. Like people, we were across the street having a drink after our preview the other night, and we ran JW and I ran into a friend of ours there, and we were like, yeah, we just finished our preview for this show, and she was like, oh, I have an OKCupid date tomorrow night. I'll come. I'll bring him. You know, and she did, and she came to our opening night. You know, so. I think a lot of people who are in like the poetry and education community are interested in what we're doing, theater people.
I bet they're more than interested, though. I bet they're very intrigued by it.
And we get our regulars from like the Green Mill Show, for example, every Sunday. They'll come out and check out the shows and just see what's going on because they follow what we do. But we also get a lot of people from industry, from, you know, quote unquote, big name theater companies that are just kind of curious about what the hell it is that we're putting together.
Yeah, I'll bet they are, because I really think you folks have come up with something new and something potentially very, I mean, not that it's not exciting now, but something terribly viable for commercial theater. I don't mean to put you in that sort of weird, you know, Broadway in Chicago.
If there's money in it, we'll take it.
But yes, that makes money too. You know what I mean? Acting in Chicago.
Yeah, these two, you just new transplants.
Yes, new transplants.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
It is certainly a great experience, particularly coming straight from college into a large city. I went to school in a wonderful little town full of 10 people and 20 cows.
Uh-huh.
called Greeley, Colorado.
Go west, young man.
Oh, go west, young man. And oh, boy. So it's been really nice to be able to get to sort of meet a bunch of new people and see what people are doing, because the nice thing about Chicago is that things are always happening here. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of new things that are happening here, which I really appreciate. Awesome. I like that sort of storefront, like hands in the dirt, creating something new sort of theater, which has been great.
That's a long tradition here.
Oh, yeah.
In Chicago. It is. It's a long tradition. Felix, how about you?
I've been here for a year. February 2nd.
You're still
new. First year in Chicago. Yeah. Still new. Little baby.
And so you're like, yes, winter is really nice. You can go
play the two best winters ever.
Yeah, this is going to ruin you.
I told him.
The last couple of this week is going to ruin you.
Oh, I know. I'm so spoiled. but Chicago has the most collaborative theater and performance in general environment that I've been in, like, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And I think that's why something like Chicago Slamworks can exist, where poetry and theater can come together in this way, because no one is afraid that their job is going to get taken by collaboration, by supporting someone, by seeing what they have to offer and wanting to work with it.
Mm-hmm. And it's also not only collaborative, but nurturing, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
On every single level. All right. I'm going to ask each one of you to give me – let's pretend that I am a – I don't know if they even have Hollywood producers anymore.
Do they?
But, you know, the famous one-sentence pitch. You're all coming into my office. You're all pitching this show. Let's start with you two youngsters.
Oh,
hi, I'm a big-shot Hollywood producer.
Yeah, I hear you're a star.
Hey, I've heard you got something interesting going on in Chicago. What's the show? The show Never Mind It's Nothing. What's that about?
You betcha. Never Mind It's Nothing is the exploration of relationships and all the dirty side of romance in a fun, sexy way.
That's pretty. Wait a minute. I'll buy it. Here's a check for $8 million.
Perfect. Half my student loans.
Felix, would you mind?
Never Mind It's Nothing. Just come.
I buy that too. I buy that too.
I don't know
too.
If I can top that.
Pause.
Never Mind It's Nothing is a modern sex farce extraordinaire examining love and relationships.
That's good. This is good. Now JW, you've created this whole thing, haven't you?
Never Mind It's Nothing. Modern sex for the modern American doing poems that are too dirty to do on the radio.
Is it, given the theatrical nature of it, are there scenes, acts?
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, describe that to me. I'm assuming and I'm getting the sense that it is the narrative that you've created, Shelley, is a pretty conventional narrative with stories that make sense and scenes, and there may be blackouts. I don't know.
Sure.
I've been really interested in this concept. I don't know, maybe I didn't make it up, but this idea of a play that exists within a play, or even if you had maybe a book and you had a collection of poems and there were scenes interspersed within the collection of poems. And if you were to lift the scenes out of the book, they would read as a play. So I was kind of interested. Like, it's something that I just am really fascinated by and have clung to, and I really wanted to try doing that with this piece. So there are a series of narrative scenes that tell a very short, very silly, farcical kind of story about a lesbian couple who is getting divorced and throwing a divorce party and all their weird friends who show up at their party.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it really kind of mirrors the rest of the mood and the themes tackled in the show.
You know, it's not my place, certainly, to be proud of you, JW. It's not.
Oh, come on.
But when you first came in a few years ago, you know, I tremendously admire you and Mark and creativity on all levels. I literally wasn't sure this was going to work. I really wasn't.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
I wasn't. And now, just in hearing you, especially you two young people and you, the writer of this whole thing, I think it's working swell. I got to get up and see it. That's what I have
Thanks,
to do.
Well, you're always welcome.
Well, I know that.
Well, yeah.
How much good tickets? We're old friends.
Yeah,
what, are you going to throw me out?
No,
you can't come see this.
I'm happy to copy, but we try. What
no,
we tried to do with this
kidding?
Show.
I would never
get out of
do
here.
That.
What we tried to do with this show is make tickets super affordable. So tickets start at $10. They go up to $20. Like, it's super affordable. It's a great night of theater. It's a lot of fun and silliness. The idea that you can come in and learn something and see some poems, but also giggle the whole way through. There's a laugh every 30 seconds at least. It's a lot of fun. It's a great show.
When we were first working on the show, we were like, oh, it'll be in February. It'll be so cold. Like, it'll be so nice for everyone to come into like a warm communal space together and laugh. And like, you know, it'll create this beautiful like escape from the winter. But even though it's 60 degrees outside, it's still great. It still works.
It's a fun show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
The show runs. It is called Never Mind It's Nothing. It runs through March 24th at Stage 773. Just go to ChicagoSlamWorks.com.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are great.
Thanks for having us, man.
He's always great. Shelley hasn't been on for 2 years. You're both new. You're all great. Best of luck with this thing.
Thank you.
You get a little commercial, then I'll have to sign off and say goodnight. Enjoy the weather. Okay, go see Never Mind It's Nothing through March 24th at Stage 773. Go to ChicagoSlamWorks.com. Tune in next Sunday. I think it's Oscar Sunday, and I think I have a one-hour show, but I'll be here. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Carl Amari, who's coming up next. Tom Hush, who is the engineer who's taken pictures and was very nice to all of these great guests. And to Aubrey Mumpower, the world's greatest engineer. The City of Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Now here with the news at 11 o'clock, brought to you by VictoryAutoRecords.com, is Roger Badish, who's my guest in 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
Yes.
But we'll see you next
week. Get ready. Prepare yourself.
Oh, gosh.
Get a lot of sleep.
You got a deal. Thank you so much.